You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. Right now, during our annual spring membership drive, your support can go even further. Contribute today at kboo.fm/give, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $12,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Maximize the impact of your support for KBOO right now.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, keeping Portland safe and in touch. Community radio has never been more important than here in the time of COVID, and KBOO needs your help. You can donate via the KBOO website at kboo.fm/give. There's also a donate button in the mobile app, or you can text KBOO, KBOO, to 44321. But the best way to support KBOO is by becoming a member at kboo.fm/give. KBOO is a nonprofit, listener-supported community resource for people like you. This is Wider Window Poetry, and I am your host, Teal Ansari, bringing you voices you may not have heard from places you may not have been. But first, a word about the places where you are. KBOO Portland is located on land that includes traditional village sites of the Multnomah, Wasco, Cowlitz, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Bands of the Chinook, Tualatin, Kalapuya, Molala, and many others, tribes who made their homes along the Columbia and Willamette Rivers, creating communities and summer encampments to harvest and use the plentiful natural resources of the area. Portland is home to almost 70,000 people descended from these tribes and others. As a latecomer to this region, descended from slaves and immigrants, I thank the indigenous peoples of the Portland area for this place of refuge. I do have a guest this month, but first I'd like to read a couple of poems by Ilya Kaminsky. Ilya Kaminsky is a Russian-Ukrainian Jewish poet born in the former Soviet Union city of Odessa. He lost most of his hearing at the age of 4. In 1993, his family was granted political asylum by the United States and they settled in Rochester, New York. Kaminsky went on to earn a BA in political science at Georgetown University and a JD at the University of California's Hastings College of the Law. He co-founded Poets for Peace, which sponsors poetry readings across the globe to support relief work, and has also worked as a clerk for the National Immigration Law Center and for Bay Area Legal Aid. Kaminsky is the author of Dancing in Odessa, which won the Tupelo Press Dorset Prize, the American Academy of Arts and Letters Metcalf Award, and Forward Magazine's Best Poetry Book of the Year Award. His book, Traveling Musicians, is a selection of his poems originally written in Russian, and his most recent collection is Deaf Republic 2019, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. I'm going to read two poems by Ilya Kaminsky. The first is titled Author's Prayer. If I speak for the dead, I must leave this animal of my body. I must write the same poem over and over, for an empty page is the white flag of their surrender. If I speak for them, I must walk on the edge of myself. I must live as a blind man who runs through rooms without touching the furniture. Yes, I live. I can cross the street asking, what year is it? I can dance in my sleep and laugh in front of the mirror. Even sleep is a prayer, Lord. I will praise your madness, and in a language not mine, speak of music that wakes us, music in which we move. For whatever I say is a kind of petition, and the darkest days must I praise. That was Author's Prayer by Ilya Kaminsky. And also by Ilya Kaminsky, a cigarette. Watch. Pasenka citizens do not know they are evidence of happiness. In a time of war, each is a ripped out document of laughter. God, deaf have something to tell that not even they can hear. You will find me, God. Like a dumb pigeon speak, I am pecking every way at astonishment. If you climb a roof in the central square of a bombarded city, you will see my people and me. One neighbor thieves a cigarette. Another gives a dog a pint of sunlit beer. That was A Cigarette by Ilya Kaminsky. You're listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Now I'd like to introduce my guest this month. Julian Safariti is a musician and scholar born and raised in Nashville to an Italian-American musician and a Vietnamese painter. In his 20s, he toured North America and Europe with an indie rock band called The Young Republic. After feeling burned out from the road, he chose a quieter life as a scholar, investigating hidden American histories in the mountains of Wyoming. He then moved to Brown University to continue his research on race, refugees, music, memory, and immigration, and everything. He has advanced degrees in American studies and ethnomusicology, as well as a degree in music from Berklee College of Music in Boston. And his second album, 1975, was released by Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. The songs in 1975, which were recorded as part of Safariti's PhD dissertation at Brown University, used traditional American folk music sounds to question the concept of the genre and who and what counts in traditionally American folk music. The album's 12 songs are guided by Safariti's desire to rethink what we think of as authenticity for popular American music, as filtered through his perspective as a first-generation Vietnamese American who came of age in the folk country and indie rock scenes of Nashville. Welcome, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I'd like you to talk a little bit about this album, 1975, and what was the genesis of it, and what, you know, what would you particularly like my listeners to know about it?
Well, really, it's just a school project run amok. That's kind of what the No No Boy Project is, and this most recent album, 1975, of course, commemorating the year that Saigon fell. When a lot of my family had to leave Vietnam. It's basically taking all the research I've done the last decade as earning all these ridiculous letters behind my name and wanting to find a way to share that research, in this case, a lot of Asian American histories and some of my work at the border and elsewhere, wanting to share what I found to be really important research in a way that people could sit with it. Not be argued at the way we do in academic discourse and larger discourse these days of politics and such, but a song, you know, it's a very ancient form of sharing news or story or history, going back to, well, many different civilizations, but I think of the Great Books course I taught once upon a time and reading Homer to the class and thinking, I wish I could have heard this sung as it originally was, you know? So whether it's that or people like Nina Simone or Woody Guthrie in the 20th century, these wonderful folk artists and great musicians who take topical songs and, I don't know, spread an awareness of history and place and interesting questions, but in a way that you can sing along to. I thought there was something very beautiful and powerful about that. So basically, yeah, I've always been a songwriter before I was an academic, and so I try to use that magical alchemy that is this mix of poetry and melody, you know, this thing called song, in order to share some of these histories that I didn't really learn growing up in high school, and a lot of us don't even know today.
Great. So I'm going to play one of the songs. This is titled Gimme Chills.
Give me right for no reason. Give me the world give me all the treason you might carry in your heart. Give me life fantastic, get me over the hill. Till the day I go, give me chills. Give me seas of blue waves tangled round my hands. Give me sand and soft shoes, evenings with the band. Sing me songs so classic, like cherry cola thrills. Lips on glass, not plastic, I know you will. Give me trial without jury, give me a melted Marcos' shoes. Give me another century to make it up to you. Hear of the same late rebellion, some say 20,000 killed. 1603, give me chills. Give me Dewey in Manila, give me the Pearl of the Orient, give me the USS Olympia, nine ships heaven sent. Scat me Christmas Eve from Doha, toast me New Year's from Crown Hill. If we never get back home, give me chills. Give me Lopez de Legazpi, from Jalisco to Cebu. Make me your religion, I'll watch over you. Dream of Spanish autumn, the New Granada to Old Castile. Over all them miles, give me chills. Give me rhyme for no reason, give me a ballad by on box. Give me Coca-Cola, Chuck Taylor's and an Apple Watch. Give me your Asian manhood, give me Duterte's sober will. Black flags in Burundi, give me chills.
So I picked that one to start with because it does involve a fair amount of history that I think is not familiar to a lot of American listeners, particularly history of the Philippines. Mm-hmm. So there are a couple of references, specific references in there that maybe you could talk a little bit about. What was the Sangley Rebellion?
Sangley Rebellion was this... Well, basically, it ended in a massacre of Filipino Chinese back in the early 17th century by the Spanish. So just maybe one of the bloodier exclamation points in a very long, twisted colonial history of that land and all those islands and stuff like that. Yeah.
And Lopez de Legazpi.
The first Spanish fellow to sail up and colonize the Philippines. So, you know, mention Lopez de Legazpi. Dewey is the American commander who takes the Philippines. His ship is the USS Olympia. Imelda Marcos of the famous Marcos regime is mentioned and alluded to are her thousands of pairs of shoes she famously had. So really it's just a, you know, it's a laundry list of proper nouns. And that's kind of where I hope, you know, if the song is on the radio or someone hears it on YouTube or Spotify, you know, maybe the tune, it's just an old love song that's kind of reworked. And I think it's pretty innocuous until you really pay attention to the lyrics, which unlike, I think, poets, is not always the case for songwriters. We don't always forefront our lyrics, but I certainly do. So yeah, if you end up just Googling kind of each one of these verses, the proper nouns, you'll get a pretty good history lesson. And that's sort of, I don't know, I think a fun way to use songs.
And that's certainly, you know, in the tradition of folk songs, in the tradition of political folk songs, mm-hmm. although typically I think at least 20th and 20th century, 20th and 21st century American protest music has tended to focus on current events more than the history.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, I grew up with a lot of that. My dad's record collection, he was an old folkie who came up in the Cambridge, Massachusetts scene, saw Dylan and Baez play a lot. You know, and the song that my dad played for me once, that I think this song and a lot of my songs are in the vein of, is a tune called With God on Your Side by Bob Dylan. Mm-hmm. It's basically like a really long, repetitive song, much like Gimme Chills we just heard, folk tradition, I suppose. But he's just re-examining so cleverly, you know, American history, revising it. In the early 60s as a very young man. And I remember my dad put that on, dropping me off when I was young in high school, and he still drove me to school with God on Our Side. He put that on, or maybe it was just on a Bob Dylan CD we were listening to. And I stayed in the car for 4 minutes after I was supposed to get out, just to hear all the verses, you know, going through the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, World War II, all these things that Dylan was going back and questioning the idea of any nation fighting for with God on their side, to quote, you know, the phrase, and, you know, how we just fought the Germans and we beat them because we had God on our side, but we forgive them now because they now have God on their side. Just truly profound. One of the, like, by far the most profound history lesson I ever learned through all my years of schooling. And also unlocking, oh, this is what a song can do. And how many more people considered American history with a critical lens? How many more people, like, just listening to that one Bob Dylan song than many of the books, you know, written about it? So yeah. I'm basically ripping off Bob Dylan.
Well, if you're going to steal from the best.
Oh, he's one of them, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to go wrong with Dylan for a model.
Yeah.
So that actually brings up sort of an interesting point, because, you know, there's this whole debate about whether song lyrics are really poetry and whether poetry can ever be any good in a song. And a lot of this conversation, at least in the U.S., has focused around Bob Dylan, because he's, you know, one of our extremely famous songwriters, certainly.
Yeah.
But, you know, is he really a poet, or is he just a songwriter, or is he really a songwriter, or is he just a poet?
Yeah.
So I, you know, as a songwriter yourself, but one who, as you mentioned, does tend to foreground the lyrics, I wonder, what's your take on that?
Well, I enjoy both poetry and songs with equal pleasure, so I don't have much of a take on it. If you're a songwriter and you're not a poet, or you're a poet and you're not a songwriter, I still enjoy what you do equally. But to the question at hand, I do think that, you know, I think of Dylan as, you know, coming a decade couched in that beat poetry stuff. And I very much see him, like, directly inheriting from Ginsberg, because Ginsberg was a mentor and who was there. And, you know, I guess if... there's this great Ginsberg quote. He was being interviewed about Dylan years later, and he said when he saw him, it was like just one column of breath when he performed on stage. And I'm Buddhist, so I go back to the breath a lot, and I think of that's the foundation of anything you utter or speak, you know, whether it's an argument or a whisper or a poem or a song. So I like to think, you know, that idea of a great poet, Ginsberg, seeing a younger peer, younger colleague, Dylan, and saying it was like seeing one column of breath. He was just so connected. I'd say that's a pretty good endorsement that Bob Dylan's a fine poet. But yeah, semantics don't matter too much to me. You know, I'm just a song and dance man at the end of the day, and I can rhyme pretty well. So, you know.
You're listening to Wider Window Poetry on KBOO, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. My guest this month is Julian Saporiti. I'm going to play another song off your album, and this is Tell Hanoi I Love Her.
I'm good. Yeah, I like this one.
Twice 7 with 2 civil wars. A fool to think that this place could ever be yours. The in-between, that's where we must explore. Tell Hanoi I love her. Jamie's mother in the nail salon. Bedazzled star, spangled t-shirt, tiger mom. Saw the flag on my hat, told me to take it off. Tell Hanoi I love her. I keep no grudge against some old world kid. Not letting go now, that's a bodhisattva's sin. I name my Chrysler after Ho Chi Minh. Tell Hanoi I love her. Cast a ballot for 45. If I'd seen what she's seen, I might see her side. Tell Hanoi I love her. I dream of junks or to sail away. Wash your feet on a beach in Ha Long Bay. My mother said once that's where dragons lay. Tell Hanoi I love her. Just as needlessly. Once I thought there was just one of me. Tell Hanoi I love her. Fumble with numbers, I just wanna sing. Ain't nothing sadder than some cook with an American dream. Sometimes I think the most communist things. Tell Hanoi I love her. Tell Hanoi I love her.
Glad you picked that one.
I find that one very moving. And it connects with me personally because my grandparents left China just ahead of the Cultural Revolution. In fact, my grandfather's father had died in jail. He was jailed by the communists. And he was much more affected by it, I think, than I ever knew. You know, being a Chinese man of his generation, he didn't ever really talk about it. But although my grandmother and my aunt went back to China to visit relatives later, you know, after the 70s when things were more open. Mm-hmm. My grandfather found it extremely difficult to contemplate returning. And I believe he did eventually go back to China, but it was difficult. It was very difficult. So, you know, and this song made me think of a lot of that.
Yeah, the idea of leaving a place, you know, leaving a home that you're kind of forced to leave is very relatable. My fiance, who sings harmony on that last song and helped produce the record, Amelia, who's a fine law student right now, doing more than just singing songs, I guess. And her grandmother, same generation as your grandparents, I guess, or they left right before the communists, or maybe after. I'm not sure. We need to look at that history more. But yeah, her grandma is was a kind of refugee of the Chinese communists, and grandfather grew up under Imperial Japan in Taiwan when it was called Formosa. So very interesting history there. And of course, for me as a Vietnamese American, you know, those stories of family members being hesitant about returning to the place they were born. God, could you imagine that? I couldn't imagine if Nashville became, you know, so volatile or so distrusting of someone like me for whatever reason that I couldn't go back. You know, like the idea, I always think about how, you know, Saigon's not even called Saigon anymore. It's Ho Chi Minh City. What would it be like if Nashville was named Donald Trump City or something? Like that alone, you know, I'm not terribly, I don't have too much pride about being from anywhere or being anything. I am what I am. But it does inform a lot of you, you know, even the city names that you're born in. You might hate the city you're from. I mean, I cite people from Boston and New Jersey, you know, trash on their homes all the time, but you've never found people more tied personally to a place name and, you know, that kind of stuff. And so just imagining that, right, trying to put things into a more, like, get rid of the death for a second, get rid of the tragedy and trauma for a second, just the idea of nomenclature, just the idea of words. We're on a poetry show, right? That shift from Saigon to Ho Chi Minh City, or from South Vietnam to just Vietnam. That's astounding if you then map that onto where you're from, if you're a privileged person like myself to grow up without a war, you know, if Nashville was all of a sudden Donald Trump town, and, you know, if Tennessee and Kentucky just merged all of a sudden. So much of my identity is in opposition to the southern states that bordered mine. You know, maybe it shouldn't mean a lot, but it does at this point in human history. And yeah, so the idea of all of our family having to leave places, and then an entire government, system of government changing, you know, better or worse, I don't know, you know, politically, but like, change is difficult. And when someone erases the place where you're from, God, what does that mean, you know?
So maybe names don't matter that much in themselves, but they're one of the ways that we create connection to place or maintain connection to place.
Yeah, the same as, you know, if yeah, I grew up in the 90s in Nashville, and it was about half the population it is now. It's become like a real booming kind of place for people to move to. And I went down to the Railroad Gulch, where I used to work for the local paper when I was a high schooler. And it used to be just train tracks down there and small little one-story buildings. It looks like they just put like 3D printed just cheap new condos right on top of the old rundown brick buildings surrounding the train yards and stuff. It's just someone put a shell on top of my old city. Even that I find, you know, deeply offensive in some ways. And I shouldn't necessarily, because now we have like stuff like tapas and sushi, which we never had growing up, and that's a win. But, you know, so if like just the facade or an extra story in a cleanup of a area of town can alter how I feel about where I'm from so much, God, imagine your grandparents or my mother, you know, leaving and then almost never going back in some cases. Her sister will never go back. I have many friends whose parents will never go back to Vietnam. And yeah.
You know, we're experiencing a lot of gentrification in Portland, which sounds similar to what you just described. For instance, Vancouver and Williams Avenue in North Portland, and even Alberta, which is close to where I live, you know, used to be pretty run down and have been sort of revitalized. There's a lot of new construction. At the same time, a lot of lower income families, and particularly Black families that used to live in that area, have been displaced because they can no longer afford the higher rents or the higher property taxes.
Yeah.
Do you suspect the same sort of thing was happening in that area of Nashville?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of it is up in North Nashville, where the Black communities have traditionally been. And a lot of that is pretty unrecognizable today. I remember when I was a kid, a tornado ripped through East Nashville, and a lot of folks were pushed out because of all this insurance money that came in, and the property started raising a lot. So yeah, story all across the United States, right?
And the same thing happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, a lot of the newer areas that were rebuilt after the destruction were much more expensive, and that the people who had lived there couldn't go back.
Yeah, it's almost like we have a problem with how we manage money in this country or something like that by the government, you know. There's I don't know. You always keep getting back to that same thing you hit your head over, you know. Well, if folks just were a little bit more taken care of in general, and we cared about things like housing and healthcare as a human right, then we wouldn't keep having the, you know. It's every city, every cool city, right? I mean, I'm a new Portlander. You know, I'm a artist, Ivy League graduate. I am the gentrifier, you know. So it's a complicated question, but a question that's always important to have, you know.
My guest this month is Julian Saporiti. This is KBOO, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. You're listening to Wider Window Poetry. I'm going to play another song. This is Saint-Denis.
Good pronunciation.
Thank you.
She had faith in life, in the world, in God, and she lived accordingly.
Soft language barrier, the child of an immigrant. Before the bar meat trucks were cool, lunch table embarrassment. That scene with the border guard last night on a continent. What was the view like, knowing that you might never come back again? There are so many things I should have said to you. Sometimes family trees cut cruel. What did you make of Tennessee in 1988, all covered in snow? The winter my little brother was born, we carried him up the hill to our home. I wish I had taking French a little more seriously. And I remember singing to you when you were dying in Saint-Denis. There are so many things I could have asked you then. Sometimes songs don't get a nice end.
It's a really beautiful song.
Yeah. I was thinking about what you're talking about with, you know, the conversation, whether or not the sort of square rhombus of is a poet a songwriter, is a songwriter a poet, you know, kind of thing. And I think if you just rearrange some of the rhyme scheme in that, we'd be at a pretty decent thing to speak, you know. There's some good imagery with an economy of words, which is not always the case in my loquacious songwriting.
I guess I do think that's a bit of a false dichotomy. I think to even ask that question, you sort of have to ignore the vast majority of the history of poetry, which is as an oral form, as a spoken form, and very commonly with musical accompaniment or rhythmic accompaniment, and sung or chanted as opposed to spoken in sort of a normal tone, normal inflection. So really, this distinction between song and poetry is pretty recent, and I'm going to be a little sarcastic and say it's largely a marketing thing, and that the big difference is you can actually get paid for songwriting. It's pretty hard to get paid for poetry.
Yeah, I guess you have to put out a great book of poems and become a novelist to get paid for your poetry. I'm thinking of who's a great Vietnamese poet, Ocean Vuong. Mm-hmm. He put out this wonderful, devastating book of poetry, and then followed it up with a novel, and his fame, I feel like, blossomed, you know, tenfold, because I'm not sure if Oprah does poetry on her book list, does she? So
yeah, I don't know.
I feel like, yeah, you got to get into that that fiction world at some point. I appreciate what you said about the history, you know, the intertwined nature. I mean, it all came from, you know, a very primordial, so to speak, like banging on rocks, learning to form communication. I think that's so interesting how those like forms of communication have flowered so much. And yeah, just how, like you said, like we started to utter and chant and then sing, right? And then rhyme and do these magical things, like how the formation of any language is amazing, but the formation of music and poetry and sort of creation is cool. I also think of like poetry and song as modes of living before they even get on my typewriter or my pencil, to be honest with you. I think of like living poetically, or living life as if it's a song, or singing life as it comes to you. I mean, this is probably some of the Buddhist stuff coming out again, but I don't find much of a disconnect between when I tap into a good rhyme or a good set of lyrics as when I walk through a park particularly well on a particularly sunny day with a good amount of dogs playing. I don't really find too much of a difference in the way I feel or the way I connect with the world. Maybe it's just a intake versus distribution difference. But I think of poetry and song often in my actions, in the way I live my life, more than what I write, I guess. So it's, for me, I guess it's even more intertwined. It's just with living, you know. Are you a poet or a songwriter? Well, I'm living, so I'm hopefully doing both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that sort of goes back to what you said about the breath, that the breath connects the music and the words, the poem and the song. If either of them doesn't have breath, then it's not alive.
Exactly, yeah. And I mean, for me, that's, I don't know. I don't know what will happen when I die, but I don't know if it'll be quite as poetic as what I've got right now. So it's a good reason to walk over to the park every morning and see the dogs playing.
So I think I'd like to extend this topic a little bit by playing the song Imperial Twist. And if you could talk a little bit about the genesis of this particular song.
Yeah. It's really nice because the way we're recording this over Zoom, I can see all the liner notes, and they're very beautiful. The Smithsonian did such a wonderful job. Old photographs of my family and my mom in her áo dài, the traditional Vietnamese outfit, and these lovely little vignettes that I forgot I wrote before each song. To summarize this next one called Imperial Twist, I was in Paris many years ago, at least five. And I was actually doing PhD work, but I had not studied this project yet, of which you're hearing a lot of the end result, called No No Boy, these songs about Asian American history. I was actually studying buskers or street musicians. That's what I wanted to do. I had this glorious plan. I felt like I had like ripped Brown University off. They were going to give me a PhD to go to Europe and just like sing in the streets for a summer, for five summers. You know, I thought I had it made, but then I got, I don't know, this misguidedly deep and settled on this No-No Boy thing. But the first summer I was over there, I was just busking all around Europe, Berlin, Milan, and then Paris. And Paris is where a lot of my family went after Vietnam. We were all French citizens growing up. And my mom said, you have to go meet up with a friend of mine, Robert Vifien. He owns a Vietnamese restaurant. And I thought, oh, this is wonderful. I'm going to get some free food. Maybe I'll learn some more stuff about my mom. That's awesome, too. But, you know, Vietnamese joints where I'm from, or like here in Portland mostly, they're mostly in strip malls kind of things, pretty cheap soup, best food in the world, in my opinion. I thought, okay, great, I'll just go hang with Robert for half an hour and he'll feed me some pho. And in that kind of casual mindset, I dressed up in a like tank top and like surf shorts and flip flops. I looked very American, to put it lightly. But then I showed up, and actually he owns the fanciest Vietnamese restaurant in Paris, which is an incredibly fancy city to begin with. Yeah, so I felt very underdressed and ashamed, like any good Asian man would, making a mistake. And he was very kind, because he actually was a huge music fan, just like tries to feed as many awesome touring artists as come through Paris at his restaurant. And he had actually discovered my old band, The Young Republic's second album, in the Paris library. And he saw that my name was the same as my mom's married name. And so that's part of how I think they got back in touch many years later. So there I was, being fed course after course, and Robert kept asking me about my musical career, because he's such a aficionado. But I was like, Robert, I want to know more about what you were like, what my mom was like as a kid, right? And he was like, oh, well, you know, I was actually in a band, and I definitely perked up. Music is the way I get through history. And he said, I was in a band, but we weren't very professional or anything, but the Americans came in during the war, and they needed rock and roll music played for them. So all these teenagers in Southeast Asia learned how to play rock and roll music. And, you know, they would buy us instruments, and they'd pack the helicopter with guitars and drums and drugs and prostitutes, and we'd fly over the jungle, and people would be shooting at us, and then we'd land, and we'd play Jimi Hendrix songs in these clandestine army bases in the middle of the jungle. And I thought, my God, that's the most incredible story I've ever heard. So I just looked up all of these Vietnamese rock bands when I got home. There was one in particular called the CBC Band, which was an amazing, amazing band. There's some recordings of them. They still gig in Houston today, where they moved as refugees. And yeah, I just had to put this story, that these Vietnamese rock bands making music, finding joy while the world was literally on fire around them. I just had to put that into a song, and that's the Imperial Twist.
Here we go.
I was pro-communist and extremely pro-American, because I really love rock and roll. Yeah, rock and roll. Changing name.
That was The Imperial Twist by Julian Safariti, who is my guest this month. You're listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. And this is Wider Window Poetry. Well, I think Jimi Hendrix would have really appreciated that.
Oh, yeah. Big hero of mine. Growing up with all my dad's records, and big hero of those bands, you know, who were playing that incredible acid rock but adding their own Vietnamese twist to it. Yeah, just amazing. Is that the grooviest thing you've played on your radio show?
Well I haven't really played a lot of music on the show. Yeah. It's been mostly poetry, although I have had a few guests who also did music, either like wrote music with poetry, wrote songs like you do, or performed with music, as a backup or as a counterpoint. So that there's been a few, but I think that was probably the rocky most
the most rocking.
Most rocking.
Great. I'll take that plaque whenever you're ready to send it. Most rocking. Yeah.
And I think that does speak to some of the things we were talking about earlier, the power of poetry and the power of music.
Absolutely. I mean, preaching to the choir. I think I love composing without words as well, and I love talking and love writing my own poetry, though I dare not go outside without my melodies attached. But yeah, it's just, you know, what can you do with a song, I guess, is like the bigger question. Or what can you do with a poem, you know, or what can you just do with a well-worded sentence, just if you really want to get crafty about it. I think that's always a question to ask. Like I said, I do intentionally forefront lyrics in my songwriting. I think the melodies are fine, the tunes are catchy, but I think very deeply about, you know, the words, and I love the format of songs. I love having to fit your, in my case, very obnoxious and unwieldy mind into a quatrain form, you know what I mean, or something like that, or have to follow an A-B-A-B rhyme scheme. There's glory in the limitation. I like putting myself in little rooms. I find it's actually, in the end, says so much more than writing hundreds of pages of prose. But that's also because, I don't know, I'm not very, what do you call it? I'm unwieldy. Yeah, unwieldy.
But there's a lot to be said for the discipline, kind of the constraint of form.
Yeah.
I think I write both free verse and formal poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I learned a lot about conciseness, certainly from writing formal poetry, but also just the discipline of having to work within the form, I think helped me with a lot of clarity.
Yeah, it's a wonderful occasion to go wild, but usually it needs to stay to an occasion, I find. Otherwise, you kind of lose meaning, and that might be great, but for me, I don't know. You know what I mean? It's like those boundaries can be very rewarding, and not necessarily in any kind of cloistered way, in a quite expansive way. I do, you know, ultimately, by going to the very small space of a song, feel like I experience a wider breadth of the world than I would, you know, writing a screenplay. But I also do love movies and wish I wrote screenplays, so maybe there's something to that.
So what's going on in your writing life at the moment? Do you have a current project?
Oh, I just sent off 180 pages of my dissertation. Chapter one, just sent that in, which is a deep listening to a Japanese American concentration camp. So this I guess practice of deep listening was coined by this woman, Pauline Oliveros, a composer and educator, and It's not unlike Buddhism if you come from that background at all. That's where she gets a lot of it from. But, you know, just listening not only to the sounds of the instrument, but the entire room, right? So if I'm singing in a room, it's not just my voice, it's also your hearing your own breath or the drops of water outside from the rain or the air conditioning, the mechanical noises as well as the environmental. And then also listening to what's beneath everything, like what listening to your own experience as you're hearing stuff, listening to your own thoughts, listening to what's not even real or there. It gets very heady, but I try to apply that to my historical study of, in this case, like a Japanese American concentration camp. So I'm reading through the old newspapers they used to print in camp and reading for any sound. So I can try to put sound back in history, because I find that history is often muted. Black and white is a more common expression, but I find muted, you know. Think of the Gettysburg Address, right? We all know how it starts, four score, et cetera, et cetera. And we know we have the text of the address, but no one really ever talked about the tone of Lincoln's voice, the quiver and the shake of a certain word, or how he ran out of breath towards the end of a cadence. No one talks about the atmosphere that day. Well, I don't even know the temperature, and how that might have caused teeth to chatter or breath to fog in front of one's face, the animal bird sounds that might have been happening, right? So it's so muted. It's overwhelmingly muted. So as a historian, I like to not only tell these kind of hidden histories, but also unmute them as well. And part of that, what you're hearing in this 1975 album is me actually going to these sites and field recording the sound of an old barrack, and turning that into maybe a snare drum or barbed wire, and maybe that's my hi-hat. And then I make beats, you know, to perform my songs on top of. So it's this sort of multi-layered deep listening to the messages of history as a narrative, I guess, but also just at literal sound, because I find that so important. Like, I can't really relate because I'm always in ears first person. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I'm working on. It was just an obnoxiously long academic dissertation chapter on a very cool subject.
Well, when you're done with your dissertation, then we might have to have you back on the show to talk about that.
Oh my gosh, you don't want to hear about that. Yeah, I'll need a few months or years to address the trauma suffered as a peon in grad school for so long. But we're on the other side of the mountain. I can see the sunrise, and it is glorious, and it is filled with song and poems. But why not both at the same time?
Great. Well, I'm going to ask you a completely random question, and then I'm going to play one more song just to finish out.
Great.
So here is your random question.
I love it. Let's do it.
What is a food you've always wanted to try, and why?
The answer, the why, is misguided masculinity in Anthony Bourdain. The food is still beating Cobra Heart.
Okay, then. Has he actually done that?
He did. Well, yeah, rest in peace. He did do that. I was a big Anthony Bourdain fan. He taught me more about Vietnam than anyone, actually. He loved that country and filmed many episodes of his TV shows there. But yeah, I remember him. It's like a BS kind of man thing where you like, and I think it's a Japanese thing, where you have a live snake and they kill it and cut out the heart, but it's obviously still beating for a little bit of time, and you swallow it and feel the beating heart. It's obviously supposed to be like some silly virility thing. But still beating Cobra Heart. I just thought, like, I don't know. I got really into mountain climbing for a while. I have a lot of, like, machismo envy or something like that. So I like still beating Cobra Heart is what came to mind. That's like the deep Freudian real answer I'm gonna give you.
All All right, this is KBOO Portland, KBOO 90.7 FM. My guest this month was Julian Saporiti. So good talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. This has been a pleasure.
And listeners, stay safe out there, stay healthy, and I'm going to play one last song to finish with.
Imagine taking a tanker ship, then walking all of Mexico. I know some people who the blues won't quit. Imagine no end to a road. They're saying out in El Paso, the prison's filled up to the brim. Now they're sticking them in cages, just sweep it all beneath the bridge. And you might want to worry, and you might want to calm down, and you might need to hurry, judging from this town. Take a jump shot in Laredo, feel some special kind of wind. Purgatory out in the morning glow, cry some special kind of tears.
El frontera, te das cuenta que la historia tiende a repetirse.
Living in between the water, just close your eyes and dream of flies. So says a mother to a daughter, wasting a life of 40 hours. And you might want to worry, and you might want to calm down, and you might need to hurry, judging from this town.
Frontera, te das cuenta que la historia tiende a repetirse. Un niño es un niño, una jaula es una jaula. Los sentimientos, las angustias, todas son las mismas. Lo único que cambia es la época.
Are you a fan of the independent film news and interviews on The Film Show? Well, you won't want to miss the new and expanded Words and Pictures, coming in 2019. That's right, The Film Show and